From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moscoane, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, America's forgotten middle class, how we got that way, and what it spells for the future. We talk with commentator and political analyst Kevin Phillips. His new book is called Boiling Point. Also, crime novelist Carl Hiaasen tells us about the Disney world that the Disney people don't want you to know. And rock historian Ed Ward looks back 40 years to 1953 when rhythm and blues was just about to give way to rock and roll. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Senate began debating the family leave bill today. The bill was passed by Congress twice before, only to be vetoed by President Bush. But President Clinton says he'll sign the measure when it reaches his desk. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Mr. Clinton came to the Capitol today in part to lobby for the bill. The measure requires companies with more than 50 employees to give workers up to 12 weeks of unpaid leave to tend to newborn children or ailing relatives. The measure's chief Senate sponsor, Democrat Christopher Dodd of Connecticut, says not enough employers have offered such benefits on their own.
According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, only 37% of all businesses in this country provide leave for a newborn child.
Republican Senator Nancy Kassebaum of Kansas argued against the measure, warning it could cost jobs.
I believe companies should offer leave to their workers, but I cannot support a government-mandated leave.
Tomorrow, Republicans are expected to try to amend the bill by attaching to it a measure writing the military's ban on gays and lesbians into law. Democratic leaders say they have the votes to defeat it. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
President Clinton filled more top posts at the Department of Housing and Urban Development today. The president named Roberta Achtenberg to be Assistant Secretary for Fair Housing and Equal Opportunity, and Andrew Cuomo as Assistant Secretary for Community Planning and Development. Achtenberg is a member of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors and a gay rights activist. Cuomo, the son of New York Governor Mario Cuomo, is the founder of an innovative housing organization. The president said that he and HUD Secretary Henry Cisneros were committed to turning the department into a center for action and a home for innovation. A report by Amnesty International says police in Europe are contributing to the growing problem of racist violence. Lynn Weil has details.
There were more than 2,000 incidents of racist violence reported in Germany last year. One of them involved a hostel for political refugees in the city of Granitz, where police allegedly pulled people from their beds and beat them with batons. In Austria, a citizen of Egyptian descent was stopped for jaywalking and subjected to racist insults. Upon refusing to pay a fine, he was beaten, arrested, and later pushed through a window. These are among the cases listed in a report just released by Amnesty International, which concludes that police forces in Western Europe are not doing enough to prevent racist behavior in their own ranks, let alone prevent racist attacks in society at large. The human rights organization is urging authorities to screen job applicants for racist attitudes and to discipline or dismiss officers who make racist comments. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Weil reporting.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost about 3 points to close at 3,328. Advances led declines by a slight margin. This is NPR. Battles between black taxi drivers and police have shaken Johannesburg for a second day. The Law and Order Minister told the South African Parliament that police had been fired on as they attempted to remove taxis blocking main roads. Two people were killed and many others injured when police fired live rounds and tear gas at the protesters. The BBC's Fergal Keane reports.
For the second day running, gunfire and tear gas have brought Johannesburg city centre to a standstill. It began with a blockade of the city by hundreds of taxi drivers. They complain of harassment by police and are demanding subsidies similar to those paid to a bus company which transports black people from the major townships to white factories and businesses. There were fierce clashes as police baton charged the drivers, fired tear gas and shotgun pellets. Speaking in Parliament, the Law and Order Minister, Hernis Creel, said he was declaring the city an unrest area, giving police wider powers of search and arrest, and the power to ban journalists from the area. It's a move commonly taken in black townships, but something the white administrators of Johannesburg have little experience of. Although the demonstrations are not linked to any current dispute between black political groups and the government, they highlight the increasingly violent nature of ordinary life in South Africa.
Fergal Keane reporting from Johannesburg. UN officials in Somalia said today that the latest round of peace talks among the warring Somali factions was near collapse. The negotiations were scheduled to begin yesterday, but still hadn't convened by this evening. A UN spokesman blamed objections raised by General Mohamed Farah Aidid, one of Somalia's stronger faction leaders. Aidid has charged his rivals with continuing violations of the ceasefire. In Mogadishu today, U.S. Marines raided a walled compound and found tons of buried weapons and ammunition. A Somali interpreter said the compound belonged to a close associate of General Aidid. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. In 1967, Kevin Phillips wrote his first book, The Emerging Republican Majority. In it, he argued that the Democrats' free-spending ways would soon doom their party. Phillips was signed up as the chief political analyst for the 1968 Republican presidential campaign and watched his prophecy come true. In 1990, Phillips wrote his next book, The Politics of Rich and Poor, in which he predicted that the Republicans were on their way out because they had alienated the middle class by pandering to the wealthy. The Republicans didn't heed his warning, and George Bush became a one-termer. Kevin Phillips has a new book called Boiling Point, Democrats, Republicans, and the Decline of Middle-Class Prosperity. In it, he details the frustration of the middle class during the Reagan-Bush years as they watched their standard of living erode. Since 1971, Phillips has been the editor and publisher of the American Political Report. He's also a contributing columnist for the LA Times and a commentator for National Public Radio. According to Phillips, there were winners and losers in the Reagan-Bush years.
Basically, what happened in the 1980s and the first couple of years of the 1990s is the United States developed a split economy almost. There were times, for example, during the mid-1980s when the people in the financial markets were doing terrifically and the coastal states were, and the energy states and the farm states were in an awful situation. That was 1985, 86, for example. But by the early 90s, what we seem to have wound up with, and it was reinforced by the need to sort of bail out the financial sector and pump up the money supply in a lot of ways to help the banks and stock market, we wound up with an economy in which there was one economy probably for the bottom 90% of the people, and that was an economy in which the middle class was stagnating generally, losing ground in some areas, and then there was another economy for the top 5-10%, especially the top 1%. And that was really going gangbusters. And there were all these signals of how something unusual was happening. When the recession developed in 1990 and 91, and I think it was certainly still with us in 1992, what you saw was that the stock market really didn't go down. In 1929, when the great crash came, the stock market and Main Street went down together, but not this time. And you had the real manufacturing and all wages, actually, the average of them, were declining at the same time as the CEOs and top executives were making more and more money. You had all kinds of people in states like California, New England, and New York, and Pennsylvania, and New Jersey in the worst downturn since the 1930s, and you had the Wall Street firms making more money than they ever had in 1991 and 1992. Something went astray.
Well, you say the really difficult time for the middle class was the late 80s into the early 90s, and how were the middle class hit?
Well, what happened from 1989 through 1992, and this was the period that the Democrats, and I think rightfully, talked about as having the weakest economic growth since the Hoover years from 1929 to 32. And basically what happened is real income for this period declined for the average family. Taxes were climbing. Health costs were soaring. Tuition costs were going up 8, 10, 11, 12% a year. There were all kinds of things that were starting to happen that don't get into the statistics. There were fees and charges. Several states started raising a fair amount of their revenues by parking tickets and speeding violations in California. They put what amounted to 170% surcharge on violations and raised quite a bit of money that way. And the average American knew that their income, the purchasing power of it, was declining. It took much more, a higher percentage of their income to buy a car or to buy a house or to do a number of things than it used to. And bit by bit, they figured out that not only was their current income, the purchasing power of it, declining, but there were all these other things happening. The pension system was getting shaky. They didn't know what Social Security was going to be 20 years from now or whether their Social Security payments would be taxed more. They worried about private pensions. They worried about whether their child getting out of college would be able to get a job, and if he or she didn't, they'd move back in. They worried about aged parents. They worried about where the United States was going. They worried about the collapse of middle-class jobs and all the big companies laying off white-collar people. And they said, we know we're not doing better. We know we're doing worse. Part of it's real. Part of it's psychological. It's to come.
Would you say that the middle class was targeted, or that what you're describing is really the result of policies which had this unintended effect?
Oh, clearly the latter. Politicians don't target the middle class for problems. They may target it for taxes because that's where the money is. But I think basically what happened in the 1980s that hurt the middle class was part of it was a result of global trends. There's no doubt about that. Basically, the United States was not where it had been in the quarter of a century after World War II. Power and technological skill and productivity were moving away from us. But the thing that made it worse in the United States and where public policy did come in is this was the decade when American policymakers started admiring the rich, admiring the entrepreneur, admiring the investor, and really not saying the things about the people in the middle that they used to back in the two decades or quarter of a century after World War II. And as you glorify the rich and as you say, give them the money and they make the economy work, cut their taxes and that stimulates investment, you're detracting from the role that the ordinary person plays in the economy.
How much would you say, and you touched on this earlier, the idea that, of course, we're in a more international market, and how much you think third world economies are really eroding the wages of the United States? Oftentimes, analysts like yourself and political people look to the 50s and 60s as the way America should be. But was that really an aberration?
Well, I think, unfortunately, it was an aberration. The period from 1945, at the end of World War II, to 1973 was a period that America can't call back. We can't have that back again. But in terms of where we're going and the extent to which third world countries are taking jobs, that's true, and it's true for two very simple reasons. The first is the spread of technology and the computer chip and so forth is making it possible for all kinds of third world countries with very low-wage workforces to be able to set up state-of-the-art plants, often owned by American or multinational companies, and manufacture things far more cheaply in Thailand or Mexico or Honduras because they can have a workforce that's paid $1.35 an hour and they can have state-of-the-art technology in the same place. And part of this reflects the second pattern, which is that in these advanced countries, the great economic powers that are past their prime, one of the things you find that the top 1 or 2 or 4% are doing is they're willing to invest their money overseas. They can make more there. They don't worry about what happens to the people in their country who aren't as well off. They'll invest their money in the plant in another country. And we're seeing that with American investors and corporations. And part of that explains part of the job movement.
Why do you think the Bush administration was so unsympathetic to the plight of the middle class? And the middle class has really been such an important voting bloc for Republican presidents.
Well, that was surprising to me because I'd been involved back in 1968 I wrote a book called The Emerging Republican Majority, which said that the fusion of suburbia and the Sun Belt was going to create a Republican presidential majority for quite a long time. And it did. And George Bush, however, was a different type of Republican president, quite a contrast with Nixon and Reagan, who were attuned to middle America. Bush was the product of Greenwich Country Day School and Andover and Yale and Skull and Bones. And when he lost a straw poll in Iowa in 1987, he said he lost because his supporters were on the golf course at air shows or at debutante parties. And he had a very warped view of where America was. He thought of America as capital gains and investors, not ordinary people in the subdivisions and shopping malls.
But that doesn't really make any sense when you look at his long political career, the fact that he was vice president for 8 years. He served in Congress. He had various other jobs within the government. How could he be so disconnected?
What George Bush thought would do it for him, and he turned out to be disconnected, but it's not hard to imagine how he thought this would work. He thought he could do it on foreign policy. He thought basically that he could run an investor-oriented economic policy, not very activist in domestic affairs, but that he would win it on foreign policy. He saw very quickly in 1989 that the beginning of the breakup of the Soviet Union was making international affairs important, and they did help him. And then, of course, the Gulf War and everything that surrounded it, the man got up to a 90% job approval rating, and he lost 60 points of that in a little over a year. So what he did is he misjudged how long foreign policy would work. But I can understand for a while why he thought that that was just going to drown out economics.
My guest is political analyst Kevin Phillips, author of the new book, Boiling Point. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Kevin Phillips, and he's got a brand new book called Boiling Point. Looking at the last presidential election, did the middle class vote for higher taxes and less services by voting Bill Clinton into office?
Well, they may have done that. They certainly didn't intend to vote for that when they voted for Bill Clinton. My sense is that, first of all, Clinton did not get a huge middle class and suburban vote. He did pretty well for a Democrat, but that was largely because Ross Perot was in there diverting so many. What people thought they were voting for with Bill Clinton was a change away from George Bush and his priorities. But Clinton was out there talking about how there'd be a middle class tax cut, not about a tax increase. And he specifically said there wouldn't be any tax increases on the people below $200,000. To pay for new programs. And if you were a lawyer and you listened to that very carefully, you could hear Bill Clinton, the lawyer, saying, but maybe for some other purpose. And that's what it's turned out to be. They're now saying that they meant that all along, that there might be tax increases to pay for deficit reduction.
Well, their reason for that is to say that the economy is worse than what they had been led to believe, or that the deficit was worse, and that a president has the right to change his mind based on the current economy.
Well, that's true as you state it, but the difficulty there, I think, is in the circumstances. Clinton was busy telling the country last year that the economy was in very, very bad shape. Now, if the economy was in bad shape the way he said, and I think he believed that, obviously the deficit was going to get worse because revenues were going to come in lower than people thought, if he was right, and the need for spending would rise because of all the problems that you'd have to be dealing with in entitlements and then in new counter-cyclical programs. So if he was correct about how poor the economy was, he was negligent in his estimate as to where the deficit was going to be.
But do you think a middle-class tax cut would be good for the economy in the long run?
There's no need for a middle-class tax cut if you stand up and you say something that's just embroidery on the other part of what he said to the middle class. In many, many of his discussions last year, he would speak about how the tax system had become unfair to the middle class during the 1980s. And he was absolutely right. Income taxes had been cut a little bit, but Social Security had gone up more than that for somebody making $40,000 or $50,000. State taxes had gone up, all kinds of local taxes. What we need in this country is to rearrange the tax system so it's not so hard on the average person and it rests more heavily on those who used to pay a much higher level of taxation. If he were to come up with some broad proposal to move in this direction, then I think we could forget about any immediate middle class tax cut. People wouldn't worry about that.
You really have detailed the systemic changes in the economy. Changing taxes, is that enough, you think, to right some of the wrongs of the 80s and early 90s?
No. Changing taxes itself, I think, is important. It's the beginning of a sign to the middle class that the ballgame would be changing. But by itself, it's not enough. I think you also have to change the whole psychology that Washington has that really does relate to this trickle-down sense that private investment is always the key, and that if you give it to the people who have the capital, skills, and education, it'll trickle down to the rest. You've got to do something that's focused more on getting people skills who don't have them now, investing in things that will enable people in the bottom two-thirds of the socioeconomic profile to get to better jobs, to be able to commute to them, to be able to have libraries, to learn something. All of this is missing now because that hasn't been part of the agenda of the last 12 years. And that has to be back in the agenda. And then globally, we have to have, and I think this is very important, we have to have an emphasis on what benefits Americans. And the notion that the United States can continue to play the same sort of global role and not worry about our own people the way we could in 1950 or even 1970 is a big mistake. If you look at these previous great powers in decline, one of the things that was characteristic is trying to do too much overseas for too long and not taking care of their own people when they really needed that reinvestment in things at home.
How would you say campaign finance reform is tied to the health of the middle class and to the health of this economy?
I think it's absolutely central for a very simple reason. One of the biggest obstacles to getting something done in Washington, and not least of all something done for the average person, is the extent to which Washington, D.C. has become the interest group capital of the world. You can go to other cities that are capitals that are separate cities for that purpose, like Ottawa or Canberra in Australia or Bonn in Germany. You don't see anything like the interest group structure. Washington is interest group central in the United States. And until you can somehow disconnect interest group money from the elections of Congress and the whole decision-making process in politics, you're going to continue to have interest group politics predominating in Washington, which is just destructive of any sort of reform for the average person. It's destructive of bringing the deficit under control. It will promote in its own way welfare statism. Interest group politics is a central difficulty of this country.
How would you rate Clinton's first 2 weeks in office? And some are already declaring him the failed 42nd president of the United States.
Well, I'd rate his first 2 weeks as kind of D plus C minus. I think he really hasn't been very good. There's something to remember about Bill Clinton. He won because people wanted to get rid of George Bush. The sense was that Bush had to go, and Clinton was the fellow there who was the alternative. Normally, you would not have somebody win the first time that he ran for president. Carter was the only one since World War II who fit that, and that was sort of a warning of problems that were there. You wouldn't have somebody elected as president who'd just been the governor of Arkansas. So what we've got here is a man who won because of the weakness of the incumbent president, who comes in without, really, in some ways, the skills package to deal with this. So I think he's had a bad first 2 weeks. I think he deserves a pretty low rating. He's probably going to have quite a bit of trouble for another couple of months. But the man is smart, and he's going to be under enormous pressure, and I think he'll be forced to repackage himself and grow to the job a bit. And I can't remember historically when anybody has been doomed by the first couple of weeks. There really isn't any precedent for that.
Do you see the gays in the military issue as a civil rights issue?
In the end?
Aspects
of it are a civil rights issue because to the extent that people are discriminated against and persecuted, even if there might be some grounds for some of the categorizations under other yardsticks, I mean, aspects of the military, you still clearly can have discrimination and abuse and so forth. So there's civil rights in there. I'm not sure that it's a civil rights issue in the largest sense of full access to the military. And that's one of the things that's going to be debated. I think Clinton has got himself a problem here because even though it does have major civil rights ingredients, it clearly also has something that involves his taking the side of changing and increasing the access of homosexuality to full cultural participation in the United States. And my understanding of polls in the United States are that you may be about 50-50 on gays in the military, but I think it's probably about 3-1 on that larger question of homosexuality. So that's the bigger issue, which is not a civil rights issue.
Well, I wonder if there's another way to look at why President Clinton is championing this idea, whether the message to the American people is, I'm willing to take a difficult and unpopular stance and take it to the end, and whether there's a larger message that he's sending to the American people, which is, I'm willing to take other unpopular stands and fight it to the end.
I suppose it's possible, but my sense of this, as someone who studies voting statistics, is that part of what Clinton is thinking about is that the gay community has emerged within the Democratic Party as, while not quite as powerful and significant as the religious right and the fundamentalists are within the Republican Party, is nevertheless very significant electorally. Some of the activists say that gays cast 6 or 7 million of Clinton's votes, which would mean that they cast about 15%. There's no doubt that there were very, very large financial contributions to Clinton from the gay community. And what you've got is a lot of people who voted for him, and quite a few of those, because they were economically conservative, had voted for Bush in previous elections. There's a major stake for the Democrats in cementing this group into their coalition. So I don't think that all of this is as divorced from politics as some people might think. Now, the problem he has is that there's a political counterforce out there that people didn't expect.
Do you think there's something that President Clinton and others who support him on this issue can do to get a kind of a conversation going about homophobia and the other issues associated with gay rights?
Maybe, but I think it's a mistake to be doing it during this period where you've just come through this period of fairly radical politics, which may still be with us, where you've had these firestorms for people like David Duke on the far right, but in other ways for a Jerry Brown and then for a Ross Perot in the center. You've got a ragged electorate. Don't put this issue out there during a period like this if you have a choice. Now, he's done it, so the question is, what's the strategy from here? But I think he would have been better off if this had been left until the economy was rising and there was a more upbeat mood in the country. Then I think it could have gone through without much attention. Having laid this out there, I think he's got to try to think up a dialogue that will calm the worries of the people in the middle, get it back on a more limited civil rights and non-discrimination and non-persecution framework, not a cultural aggrandizement framework.
Well, do you think he needs James Carville back?
Absolutely. I think one of the first things they should do is get Carville out of the bayous on the pirogue or whatever he's doing. Get him back there. Give him an office. Make him a resident voice of Middle America. Carville had a sense of where the average fellow was. These policy wonks that Clinton is surrounded with don't. They really need him back.
Mickey Kaus, actually this was in this week's Newsweek, has a review of your book, and he begins by saying Kevin Phillips is the political equivalent of a cross-dresser. What do you say to that?
Well, I don't know enough about Kaus to say what he's the political equivalent of. But
some name-calling.
Yeah, I suspect that what he's saying and what he did say in that is that I'm somebody who's known as a Republican that by his yardsticks doesn't sound like it.
Right.
But it's kind of amusing to me that I guess he's a Democrat, but he looks to me sort of like a gopher for the conservative foundations in some of what he writes. So one of the things that we've seen in politics in the last, especially in this election, all kinds of blurring of lines. 27% of the Republicans didn't vote for George Bush. They voted for Ross Perot or Bill Clinton. These lines are really blurring.
Well, I thank you very much, Kevin Phillips, for joining us today.
Thank you. Nice to talk to you.
Kevin Phillips is a political analyst and author of the new book, Boiling Point. I'm Marty Moscow-Wain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen with Fresh Air. As an investigative reporter and columnist at the Miami Herald, Carl Hiaasen writes about how tourism has changed his state. As a crime novelist, Hiaasen has set his latest novel at a third-rate Florida theme park. It's just out in paperback. Coming up, Carl Hiaasen on the dark side of the Magic Kingdom. Also, 40 years ago, rock and roll was the revolution that was just about to happen. Rock historian Ed Ward helps us remember the seminal year, 1953. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Clinton has told the nation's governors this week that he will give them the elbow room needed in order to experiment with health care and welfare reform. During the governor's annual meeting in Washington, Mr. Clinton pledged to make it easier for states to bypass federal Medicaid and welfare requirements. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Following up on his pledge to, quote, end welfare as we know it, President Clinton promoted his proposals to reform the system today during the closing session of the governor's annual meeting. His plan includes more funding for job training and expanding the earned income tax credit for the working poor. He also suggests cracking down on parents who fail to pay child support and requiring parents to get a job in the private or public sector after 2 years on the welfare rolls. Mr. Clinton emphasized that he's prepared to give states the latitude that's needed to experiment with both welfare and health care systems at the local level. He promised to grant waivers so states can innovate in how they use federal dollars. But let's measure these experiments, he said. If they don't work, let's have the courage to quit and admit it. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the White House.
On Capitol Hill, Senate Republicans have been attempting to amend a family leave bill to give employers more say in the matter. But the bill appears on track to be the first approved this year. The measure was vetoed twice by President Bush, and President Clinton has called for a bill free of amendments. This measure would require companies with 50 or more workers to offer 12 weeks of unpaid leave in the event of a family sickness or birth of a child. Officials at the Labor Department say about 40% of the workforce would be affected by the measure, but only about 5% of the nation's employers. 7,000 members of the United Mine Workers Union remain on strike this evening against Peabody Coal, the nation's largest coal producer. NPR's Cheryl Duvall reports.
The first day of the mine workers' strike saw picketing at Peabody sites in 8 states, from West Virginia to Montana. Each side in this dispute is accusing the other of refusing to bargain in good faith over the terms of a replacement for the union contract that expired Monday. The union contends that Peabody is trying to keep out its members when it opens new mines. Peabody claims that the union is overreaching its bounds by trying to represent workers at those non-union work sites. Neither the mine workers nor the company responded Tuesday to efforts by the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service to bring the parties back to the bargaining table. I'm Cheryl Duvall reporting.
The government says that sales of new homes climbed more than 19% last year, after falling to 509,000 in 1991. The 1991 sales rate was the slowest since 1982. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 3 points. This is NPR News. According to Democratic officials, President Clinton is said to be considering a $31 billion short-term plan to stimulate the economy, comprised of money to create jobs and tax breaks for business. Clinton aides have said a plan now under consideration would call for $16 billion in immediate spending increases and $16 billion in investment tax credits. Along with this plan would be proposals to cut the nation's deficit and promote long-term growth in the U.S. economy. Also said to be under consideration is a plan to increase the amount of taxes that people collecting Social Security have to pay on their benefits. U.S. officials in Panama believe that 3 U.S. missionaries have been kidnapped by Colombian rebel forces. The 3 were working in Panama near the Colombian border. NPR's Derek Reveron reports.
U.S. embassy officials said the missionaries were taken from a small jungle town early Monday morning. Armed men entered their homes, tied them up, and took them away, leaving their families behind. The three men are from the New Tribes Mission in Sanford, Florida. They were living in an Indian village near a region known to have Colombian guerrillas. Mission spokesman Mel Wymuth said he doesn't know why the men were kidnapped.
They're now in Panama City. Authorities in Panama are currently endeavoring to establish the identity of the armed group and their reason for taking the missionaries captive. We have heard absolutely nothing from them, and they gave no reason to the wives either as to why they were doing this.
In 1985, another New Tribes missionary was kidnapped by Colombian guerrillas. He was returned a month later. In Miami, I'm Derek Reveron.
According to reports from Bonn, the German government will announce next week that prices this year are expected to rise faster than wages. It's the first time that's happened in Western Germany in nearly 10 years. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Carl Hyacin's official bio says he was born, raised, and still lives in what's left of South Florida. Hyacin has worked on the Miami Herald since 1976, first as a reporter and now as a columnist. He also writes detective fiction. While his column lets him rail against greedy developers and corrupt politicians, his fiction gives him a chance to rewrite the news stories that come across his desk and give them happy endings. I first spoke with Hyacin when his novel Native Tongue had just been published. It's now out in paperback. It takes place in a familiar Florida setting, a tacky theme park.
You live in Florida and you write about tourism in the business industry in Florida, and you write about theme parks. Everybody and their grandmother's got a theme park, and of course Disney World is the ultimate theme park. And years ago I had gone and done some work on lawsuits that had been filed against Disney World because I thought it would be kind of funny to see what kind of things happen that we don't hear about normally at Disney World, which is sort of this hermetic Android, Stepford Wives sort of atmosphere. So I thought it would be fun to see what was really happening, and there were some fantastically funny lawsuits. Well, there was one that sticks in my mind. It was either Pluto or Goofy, and I get those two mixed up, so you'll have to forgive me, but it was during the Main Street Parade, which is like the culmination of the big festivities every day at Disney World. They have a Main Street Parade. All the characters come out, and Mickey and Minnie, everyone sings and dances. Well, I guess on this particular day, it was either Goofy or Pluto. It had a really, what you would call a bad day at the office, apparently. And he's prancing and dancing down Main Street, USA, and some little kid comes out and tugs on his tail. And the allegation of the lawsuit was that Pluto or Goofy then turned and drop-kicked the kid right across the parking lot. And I thought to myself, this is wonderful because reality has intruded. I mean, that's the sort of thing I would pay to see as a tourist. I mean, forget the parade. That's funny. I mean, nobody was injured. I mean, there was some allegations that the kid was traumatized and that, he was going to grow up to be a sniper or something. But the fact of the matter is, it was just sort of one of many, many very weird, their people had expired, for example, on a couple of the rides. Now, you have to then prove were the rides the cause of the death or not. And I know that's not funny, but in many cases, there were not rides that you would expect someone to particularly die on. So I got some ideas from that. I thought, now, what if you had a theme park that wasn't as careful as Disney World? What if you had a theme park that was sort of a cut-rate Disney, where the engineering talent probably wasn't quite up to snuff with what Disney would have used? And that was my idea for Native Tongue and creating this theme park in that book.
I must say, from my limited experience in Disney World, it's the only city I've ever visited where I want graffiti and garbage.
Right, you do. You have this longing for some sort of, as I said, reality, something to happen that isn't planned, that's spontaneous, that's fun without being orchestrated fun. And that's why all of us who live in Florida, and especially people who live in Orlando, kind of get a little bit of a kick out of it when something happens at Disney World. I don't mean it's something catastrophic, but something that they can't control. A few years ago, the place was invaded by black vultures who had been moved out of their native habitat. And so, like everyone else, they thought Disney World looked pretty darn good. But, of course, black vultures don't exactly fit in with the Main Street Parade, sort of harmony. And there was a great scandal because some of the vultures were confronted in a rather violent way by Disney employees. And, but I mean, to me, all of us in Florida sat back and laughed and said, okay, there you go, deal with that.
Well, you even say in your book you seem to imply that Disney World is a much more insidious form of entertainment.
You write, well, let me read this. The mouse's sprawling self-contained empire sucked tourist pockets inside out. They came, they spent until there was nothing left to spend. Then they went home happy. To lifelong Floridians, it was a dream concept, fleecing a snowbird in such a way that he came back for more. Astounding. Are you speaking for all Floridians?
I think I'm speaking for many Floridians, because it is an incredible concept that people come, and Disney is so shrewd that they have taken care of, literally from the time you step off the plane to the airport, I mean, you are in their clutches, both emotionally and otherwise. And I mean, and they, the food, your hotel, if you want, your every form of transportation, if you want to play golf, there's nothing that you want to do that they can't arrange and that they'll be very happy to take your money for. And that, after all, is what the tourist industry is all about. So we in South Florida have always looked upon that strategy with great envy, because it seemed to us for a long time down in Miami and Fort Lauderdale that Disney World in Orlando was sucking all our family tourist business away. I mean, they had just literally drawn almost a line across the state below which tourists need not go anymore. And so there is sort of a jealousy and inferiority complex that we live with down there.
Your protagonist, Joe Winder.
Joe Winder. Yeah.
Is an investigative journalist who works in the public relations department at a rival theme park to Disney World called the Amazing Kingdom of Thrills, right, which is located in South Florida.
Is that
your greatest fear, that somehow, as a journalist, you're going to end up putting out cheerful press releases for some corporation?
There is a high burnout factor in journalism. There really is. It's hard to last a long time and keep your sanity and keep a normal family life and all that. And so in corporations, big ones, are always in the market for experienced journalists to come work in public relations, because journalists know how other journalists think and how they can be not just manipulated, but also to be made comfortable. I mean, if you know how newspapers and TV stations and radio stations work, then it helps when you're dealing with those people to have someone who with some expertise and background in it. So I think that for a lot of reporters, particularly with myself, with my background is in investigations, and for me to wind up in a place like that would sort of be tough on, I think, my pride and ego for a while, and that's what's going on with Joe.
Carl Hyacin is my guest. He's an investigative journalist and a columnist for the Miami Herald, and he's written a number of novels. His latest book is called Native Tongue. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Novelist and journalist Carl Hyacin is my guest. You seem to be very attracted to rather convoluted plots. We have in this book an eco-terrorist. We have a blue-tongued mango vole.
An endangered species
stolen from the park. The president of the theme park is hiding out in the witness protection program. Winder's girlfriend is a phone sex operator. There's a roadkill gourmet. There's a kind of oversexed dolphin. What do you have against simplicity of storyline?
Oh, I think the story is simple. I think the characters are a little complicated. I live in a place where there are no simple stories, and so I don't write simple stories. I mean, nothing is as it seems in South Florida, so I'm not used to a simple linear storytelling mode. I mean, I put as many interesting characters as I can into the novels, because I like people to be sort of intrigued and want to find out how did they get that way. I mean, how does a former governor of Florida wind up living in the swamp eating roadkill? And I mean, these are not just demented figments of imagination. They're all inspired by an event or a person or something that, you know, that really, really happened.
Well, I must say also in your novels that many of your characters meet strange and violent deaths. There is a killer whale that expires eating a park employee. A president of the Greater Miami Chamber of Commerce is chopped up and put in a suitcase, strangled by a rubber alligator.
Well, that's just a personal fantasy of mine.
Let me go on here. There's a composting accident. There's a woman in a condo eaten by a crocodile. Is this a window into your fantasy life?
Well, I got to say that when in Florida, growing up in Florida and seeing it's a place of immense beauty and just incredible natural power, nature still has a pretty strong hand. And despite our best efforts to pave it over and neutralize it, that nature occasionally strikes back. And I always root for nature in those circumstances. When a crocodile comes in contact with a human being and does what crocodiles tend to do, which is eat, I have to say I end up rooting for the crocodile most of the time.
Now, your critics say that you hate Florida, and that's why you say all these terrible things about the people who live there.
No, I love Florida. I just hate what they've done to it.
Well, I know that you grew up there. You're probably one of the few people that can say you were actually born in Florida. You only live a couple of doors from where you did grow up,
right,
outside of Fort Lauderdale. What's the Florida of your youth?
Well, it was still a place where you could, you know, get on your bicycle if you were a kid, and literally I was within riding distance of the edge of the Everglades, and you go out there and you fish and you catch snakes and critters, and you, as far as the eye can see, you see nothing but swamp and nothing but green, and now you see nothing but concrete. And I don't think that's an experience that's unique to Florida by any means. I get letters from people all over the country who've read the books who have experienced the same pain and the same sick feeling in their gut when they go home and they see something that's happened in their hometown to a place that they had fond memories of. There's nothing unique about the experience, but in Florida, it is the predominant experience of people that have grown up there to see a change, and it's happened very rapidly and with great cataclysmic effects on the environment, to the point now that this is a state where the state mammal, which is the Florida panther, is now nearly extinct. The state sea mammal, which is the manatee, is down to the last couple hundred. The state fish, the largemouth bass, is inedible due to mercury poisoning. I mean, it's a pretty sad legacy. Where, you know, it's the kiss of death to make something the official state creature of Florida, I guess.
Where do you go on vacation, since everyone comes to Florida?
Where I go, I try to go to Montana once a year, which is, you know, beautiful and largely unpopulated. I try to pick the states where the population's actually declining and then go there and float the rivers in Montana. I spend a lot of time in the Keys, which are still quite pretty if you know where to go, the Florida Keys, and you know where to go and you know where to hide. And I'm not just talking about the tourists, but from the general population increase down there. But there are enough islands to get lost in down there that if you got a boat, you can get away from it. And I spent a lot of time down there in Everglades National Park and in that area. And there are still places to go where you will not see another boat the whole day. And that's kind of not very many places you can say that about.
Now, see, I would think people hearing you would say, hey, let's go to Florida, and you're going to get another whole packload of tourists.
Well, I think as soon as they get the first cloud of mosquitoes going down their clothes, they may reconsider, because there's nothing like an Everglades Park mosquito early in the morning to make you wish you were somewhere else.
Carl Hiaasen, thank you very much for joining
Marty.
Us today.
Carl Hiaasen is a columnist for the Miami Herald and the author of the novel Native Tongue. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Linda Wertheimer has joined us to tell us about the news today. Linda, I understand that President Clinton was on Capitol Hill today.
Paying a call on the Congress, emphasizing that they are all Democrats together, trying to get some interest ginned up in his new family leave bill. There's also news coming out, Marty, about the president's economic plan. We'll have something on that. Talk to a congressman who's interested in the president doing something about the deficit. He's one of the Democratic deficit hawks. Ted Clark will be around to talk about Mideast peace talks and how that's going to work in the Clinton administration. We'll have more on the coal strike and a piece from Ann Cooper in Somalia.
Thank you, Linda. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
the beginning of each year, rock historian Ed Ward likes to look back to earlier decades. So now Ed takes us back 40 years to 1953, when rock and roll was just a few hits away.
Now you're looking at a man that's getting kind of mad. I had a lot to look, but it's all been bad. No matter how I struggle and strive, I'll never get out of this world alive.
1953 certainly didn't start out looking like a banner year for American popular music. Hank Williams, the singer and songwriter whose work had revitalized country music and had even been covered by pop artists, fulfilled the promise he made in the song that was number one on the country charts at the start of the year. On his way to play a New Year's show in Canton, Ohio, debilitated by drugs and alcohol, he died in the backseat of his limousine. He left a gaping hole in country music that would take a couple of years to fill, although he also thoughtfully left several more hit records, including his best-known hit, Your Cheatin' Heart, unreleased at the time of his death. No, for signs of hope in popular music in 1953, we have to turn to the field of rhythm and blues. There, some of the roots of the rock and roll revolution that was just a few months away were beginning to show.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog. Been snooping around my door. You ain't nothing but a hound dog. Been snooping around my door. You can wag your tail, but I ain't gonna feed you no more.
Willie Mae Thornton's hit, written by Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller, two Jewish high school students in Los Angeles, was important for several reasons. Not only did it wind up in the impressive record collection of young Elvis Presley, but it gave birth to Sun, the record company that he would record for next year. This was their first big hit.
You know what you said about me, don't you, woman? Well, you ain't nothing but a bearcat. Been scratching at my door. You ain't nothing but a bearcat.
Rufus Thomas's Bearcat was even labeled the answer to Hound Dog on the record. Not only did it sell well enough to launch Sun Records, it prompted a lawsuit from Lieber and Stoller charging copyright infringement, a suit they won. But Rufus Thomas was already a legendary disc jockey in Memphis, and Sam Phillips, who owned Sun, made enough money on it to firmly establish the label. Looking at 1953's rhythm and blues top sellers today, it's obvious that a corner was being turned. Half of the chart is down-home, old-fashioned blues by B.B. King, Little Walter, Eddie Boyd, and Willie Maybon, while the rest is quite sophisticated urban stuff. Old-style jump blues by Amos Milburn and Big Joe Turner was still around, but there was something new. Groups.
You know the landlord rang my front door bell. I let him ring for a long, long spell. I went to the window and peeked through the blind and asked him to tell me what was on his mind. He said, "But honey, yes, but honey."
The year's best-selling rhythm and blues single was Money Honey by Clyde McFadder and the Drifters. And although McFadder was right up front, the song was clearly a group effort. In fact, McFadder also charted in 1953 with the group he'd just been fired from, with a record that is one of the most harrowing listening experiences in rock and roll.
Brothers and sisters, we are gathered here.
Therefore, black horses with eyes of flame red, their roses tied with ribbons all around my baby's head. The bells are ringing, and they say, I'll go and see.
The wail of grief that ends this record has to be heard to be believed. This was also the year the Orioles broke out with Crying in the Chapel, which put them on the pop charts, and another important group, the Clovers, hit with Good Lovin'. But the group that was the most important from a historical perspective was the Five Royales, the group that would be one of the most influential bridges from the old R&B style to soul music by the end of the decade. And in 1953, they had two hits, Too Much Lovin' and Baby Don't Do It. Solo artists, too, were beginning to change the sound of black music. Although the year's biggest was Faye Adams with Shake a Hand, Ray Charles had just been signed to Atlantic, where he was beginning to invent soul music. Little Richard was making his first recordings in a restrained blues style. And in New York, the big news was Ruth Brown.
While young men like to have a good time. While young men like to have a good time.
That August, young Elvis Presley finally got up the courage to walk into the Memphis Recording Service and make a record for his mother. On his next trip there, he'd change the world.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle.
Well, that's all right, Mama. That's all right for you. That's all right, Mama. Just any way you do, that's all right. That's all right. That's all right. Told me, Papa done told me too. Son, that gal you fooling wish she ain't no good for you. But that's all right. That's all right. That's all right, Mama, anyway do.
Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy with Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Penny Nelson. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen.
I'm leaving town, baby. I'm leaving town for sure. Well, then you won't be bothered with me hanging round your door. But that's all right. That's all right. That's all right, Mama. That's all right. That's all right, Mama, anyway.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next edition of Fresh Air, the inexhaustible mystery of love found and lost. We talk with novelist Robert Boswell about families, about writing, and his latest novel, Mystery Ride. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.